I'm Anthony Wright, and you're listening to Attunement, and I'm here with Rabbi Abner Weiss. Welcome, Rabbi.
Hi. Good to be with you.
You have written a book called Connecting to God, the Ancient Kabbalah and Modern Psychology. And tell me about Connecting to God.
Let me first tell you about the book.
Yes.
And then you'll see where I'm coming from.
Okay.
I wanted to do three things in the book. Firstly, because Kabbalah has become a buzzword in contemporary culture, I wanted people to know what is Kabbalah. So the first part of the book is the history of Kabbalah and its major teachings. And of course, Kabbalah is the ancient Jewish mystic tradition. All mystic traditions aim at achieving connection with God. In the East, yoga means God union.
Yes.
In the Kabbalah, the word which is used is dveikut. In all of these traditions, the purpose is accessing the divine within you and realizing that that's really all that there is of you, that the other stuff flakes off and goes away and keeps changing as we get older. The cells go about their business doing other things in the universe, and new cells replace them. And the other way is not just by going into yourself, but also in transcending yourself and joining yourself to the all, so that the distinction between the me and the not me gradually fades away. That's the mystic quest. And the Kabbalah has its way of achieving that. So this is the first part of the book. The second part of the book is, what can the Kabbalah do for me and for you and for people who have problems? Because I discovered that within this very arcane and difficult literature, most of it in Aramaic, there is an almost complete psychological system which is based upon spirit and upon spiritual energies. So that dysfunctional ways of thinking and feeling and relating and being in the world come from blocked energy centers and imbalance in our energy centers. So what I do in the second part of the book is, after I create, as it were, you'll forgive the mixed metaphor, an anatomy of our spiritual genome, I then suggest ways, both mystical and very well tested clinical, of dealing with the problems, with the blockages, with the imbalances. That's the second part of the book. And the way in which I approach it is by telling the stories of people who've been helped by this approach, so that it isn't academic. It's very real.
And very practical.
And I must share with you, Anthony, something that happened recently. I was being interviewed on some show, and at the end of the interview, the interviewer said, "Can I speak to you privately?" And I know what that means. And I said, "Of course. What do you want to tell me?" He said, "I'm in your book, but much worse than the case of so-and-so. And I don't want to reveal, because that will give away the gender of the interviewer." And I said, "And what did the book do for you?" And the response was, "It's opened everything up, and I've decided to move to another place and explore the possibilities that I know that I really have." Amazing. This was somebody else's story resonating with this person's personal experience. So that's the second part of the book, what the Kabbalistic psychological system can do. But that's only important as a stepping stone, because if you're stuck in your old patterns, in your old dysfunctions, if you're hearing the old tapes, if you cannot let go of the old hurts, if you maintain the spiritual imbalance inside of you, then it becomes impossible to move on spiritually. Because if you're psychologically paralyzed, you're not spiritually free. And the third part of the book is how healing can lead you to wholeness. And there are meditation techniques, awareness exercises, even ways of appropriating old prayers so that the words are not just words, that they can become springboards to connection with the infinite. And all of this using cutting-edge contemporary neuroscience, for example, in the meditations. So that's really the third part of the book. The third part of the book is connecting.
And you also have a CD, is that right, that people can
Yes, I have a order. CD which is on the website, connectingtogod.com. And the CD is also very interesting. And have you received a copy yet?
No, but I looked in the book and I saw that there's some theta brainwave underpinning, and I'm going, yes.
I must tell you where this started. You're going to love this. As a person who was a seeker at Saybrook.
Oh, yes.
When I started thinking about this book, I heard about Alma Green, who was at Menninger at the time. He was an old man. And I'd read Alma Green's book, in which he describes the very first work, financed, believe it or not, by the National Institute of Mental Health. Our government financed his trip to India to put EEGs on yogi meditators. And then he discovered that when they were in deep meditation, they had achieved theta brainwave pulses. He comes back to Menninger and using feedback, biofeedback machines, he's able to get his students, because students are the experimental rats and mice in all scientific work, he gets his students to achieve theta and finds that some of them are reporting psychic experiences, some of them paranormal experiences, some of them creative experiences, and I figured, this is it. Now I understand meditation. And I write that chapter, give it to my editor, and she says, Alma Green's work is 30 years out of date. Whoops. The science was sound, but it gets better. So I said,
oh, great.
Yeah, what's happened since then? She says, look up Daniel Goleman. I said, emotional intelligence?
Yes,
no.
Yes.
The Dalai Lama invited him to write up a research project and to be present at a seminar of Buddhist meditators and American neuroscientists in which they used not EEGs, which are kind of primitive, but functional MRIs. Daniel Goleman describes the neurological pathways for transcendence. Comes along Anthony Newberg just a year or two ago.
Yes, and I...
He was one of the contributors to What the Bleep. And he does the same work with Franciscan nuns because he has a hunch that this kind of transcendent experience is possible not only in profound meditation, but also in prayer states, when you're enraptured by music. So he gets nuns and meditators, and he uses PET scans to trace brain activity, and he comes to the conclusion that there is such a thing, now listen to this, as neurotheology. Wild. It's the interface of neurology and theology.
That's
showing how we are absolutely hardwired for experiences of transcendence. Now, how does he explain it? I mean, it's mind-bending. He says, the first act of cognition, of conscious cognition, is to separate the me from the not me. As soon as I have made that distinction between me and not me, I can study objects, I can study people, I can study concepts. But most Western thinking has used that part of the brain that makes the distinction between me and not me. In meditation, that becomes quietened. And the part of the brain that fades the borders between the me and the not me. So here I have the tools, and I find that there's a guy in Southern California, Dr. Jeffrey Thompson, who is able to embed these theta rhythms into his music. So I call him and I said, if I do the voiceovers of the guided meditations from the book, will you compose music and put the theta rhythms subliminally, because people can't,
right.
So that they will fly into the meditations, and that's
yes.
what the meditation tape produced.
That's wonderful.
And that's one of the techniques for mm-hmm. connecting to God.
Are you familiar with the work of a minimalist composer named Steve Reich?
No. Tell me about it.
He's fairly well known. He's a percussionist, and he went to Bali mm-hmm. to study the gamelan orchestras.
Yes.
And there's a piece of music that I'm very, very fond of called Music for 18 Musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 70 minutes of people going dun, 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 dun in various patterns. And I took a metronome and I did the meter check.
Let me guess.
And by God, it's
theta.
Theta brainwave.
I could have guessed that.
I want to come back to neurotheology. Was that what
he
it was?
He called it neurotheology.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And he called his book, Why God Just Won't Go Away. You know, there are other things which I show in this book which are quite mind-bending.
Please.
In terms of cutting-edge science. You know, when you believe that you are going to be read by several hundred thousand skeptics,
mm-hmm.
you have to back up some of the craziness. Now, the Kabbalah, for example, says that there are a whole lot of invisible universes. And it focuses on five universes, our visible universe, and four which are not visible. And it speaks about the unfolding of the divine through these universes until it becomes less and less subtle and more concealed within us. However, talk about invisible universes. 20 years ago, people would have thought you're a candidate for a nut house.
Yeah.
Now, Stephen Hawking and the best cosmologists using subatomic physics are arguing that although we can't see them, because we're on a membrane of time-space.
M-theory, yes.
Yeah, he called that the brain new world, brain for membrane. Welcome to the brain new world. And here is this ancient theory of invisible universes suddenly validated by the newest science.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things that I put in for the skeptics. The other was this neurophysiology, so that people who are skeptical about the possibility of self-transcendence as not a subjective, delusional experience, but as a measurable, objective experience, becomes convincing. I spoke about
PET scans.
Right, CAT scans, PET scans,
mm-hmm.
fMRIs. I mean,
yes,
fMRIs
functional.
Are way beyond MRIs. It shows mm-hmm. how the different parts of the brain interface dynamically. But then I had a deal with reincarnation. And every Jewish audience that I've addressed on this, because it's fundamental to Kabbalah, as it is to most mystic mm-hmm. systems, every Jewish audience that I've addressed start off with, so there's some guy who raises his hand or some woman who says, but we Jews don't believe in that, do we? And the reason is that nobody's told them about this deep, dark secret, which was embraced by all the great rabbinic leaders down the ages mm-hmm. until the age of rationalism, when it became unfashionable to talk about anything that you couldn't prove. So
uh-huh.
Weiss has to speak to the skeptics, and he begins to assemble evidence from very respectable MDs, psychiatrists, most of them, who've used past life regression. Now, I trained in hypnotherapy at UCLA, but we were told that it's impossible. Those memories are implanted by the hypnotist until there were some cases which became irrefutable. In each case, we find either clinical or empirical evidence or scientific evidence for stuff which seemed to be slightly edgy before or completely nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kabbalah predicted that there would be a surge of interest in mysticism in general and Kabbalah in particular as human knowledge would explode exponentially. And that certainly happened during our lifetime. But what's really happened is that physics,
the most empirical of them all,
has discovered territories which it knows are there, but which it cannot explain in the subatomic world, how an object can be and not be simultaneously,
right.
Be in one place and in another place simultaneously.
Yeah.
These are old mystical truths. So what the Zohar predicted so long ago is happening now. Science and theology are gradually beginning to interface instead of facing off as they did in the past.
Well, I think it's going to be quite an interesting process of awakening for those who have invested, those academicians and scientists who have invested so heavily in the absolute positivist Cartesian viewpoint.
And that has been seriously undermined. It doesn't mean that there is no value in that. There is value. There's abundant value. But it also means that that is only part of the truth and that only describes part of our reality.
So in looking at a diagram of the Tree of Life, I've only seen a flat representation of it. And from there's a friend who practices Tarot and looks at the Kabbalah from the hermeneutic viewpoint. But she said that the Tree of Life is multidimensional, not just three-dimensional.
Oh, yes. The Tree of Life, what we call the Etz HaChaim, really is a representation of the building blocks of the cosmos. Which
really?
It's not just the energy system in the human being, you know, the energy centers of cognition and emotion and relationship and being in the world. Not at all. Those are the building blocks of everything in the cosmos. And therefore, as complex and dynamic as the cosmos is, each of these energy systems is complex and dynamic and interrelating. They're not three-dimensional, they're multidimensional. We speak about, for example, the Gevura which is in Chesed, and the Gevura of the Gevura which is in Chesed, so that there are layers upon layers. Oh yes, it is alive. It is the spiritual genome of the universe.
In an energetic way?
In an energetic way. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Because ultimately, all that is real is energy.
Yeah. And I was looking at this and I thought, now all these centers, they seem to be not exactly chakras in the East Indian sense,
but they're
close. Resonance.
Pretty close. Okay. They resonate with the chakra system. When you speak about the Keter, which is the crown, and you speak about the Chochmah, which is the wisdom. It's an energy center above the head, an energy center in the head.
Right.
You speak about Bina. You speak about Da'at. You can see the Asna, and you speak about Tiferet, which corresponds roughly to the heart chakra. You speak about Yesod, which is very resonant of the Kundalini energy.
At the root.
At the root. And that's called the foundation. Your sword is foundation. And so, yes, but that must be, Anthony, because truth is universal. There may be different takes on the truth. There may be different aspects of the truth. Kabbalah is not the same as Eastern mysticism, but it resonates with many of the truths because it must.
Yeah,
because
I'm so
truth
glad.
Is truth.
Yes. Exclusive of any label,
yes,
or book, or any cognition that one that a human would attempt to place upon it.
Truth has to be truth, and truth has to be universal. There may be,
isn't the truth?
Right,
it's a separate deal.
But the ultimate truth only belongs with the divine. We see aspects of the truth, like we see light refracted through a prism. So we see elements of the light. So we get different elements of the truth. And these elements are revealed to different people. And they take these elements of the truth and they develop them. And they grow with them. And this is the element of the truth that was revealed in the Kabbalah, which is a deep level of Torah, obviously, therefore, has to resonate. And I believe that that's why Kabbalah has become so popular in the Western world, because there is the sense that since Christianity and Islam are rooted in Judaism, that the Jewish mystic tradition will talk to people of those faiths as well, although they have their own mystic traditions.
Yes. Equally, well, but they're rooted with the truth.
Sure, sure. They have to be rooted in the truth.
Well, and actually, I'm just continuing to be a bit overwhelmed by this notion of neurotheology.
Oh, boy. It blew me away. And it shouldn't have done, because it has to be.
Well, that's right. I mean...
Do you know, when you think that no brain has ever thought a thought, that sounds like a paradox. No brain has ever thought a thought. It's the same as saying no computer has ever thought a thought.
Well, right.
The computer programs what you put into it. It stores it. It operates with it. It retrieves it. That's what the brain does. The brain cells. But the thinking energy utilizes the brain. The brain is the hardware. That's why I say we are hardwired for transcendent experience. But the brain is not going to lead to transcendence unless we program it. Unless we activate those parts of the brain that can lead us to connecting with God.
So, would you speak about then what you understand human awareness to be?
Human awareness really comes on various levels. There's rational conscious awareness, and that's the old Kantian notion that everything that we have derives from our senses, and we put our senses together from sensation to move to perception, from perception to conception. That is an energy center. That's part of our brain. It's popularly called the left part of our brain, left brain activity. Then there is another element of consciousness, and that is superconsciousness, that is intuition. That's when you're able to tune in to something from the outside, like when you switch on your radio or your television. We have antennae for that. Sometimes we get those signals almost accidentally. And those are the great ahas of scientific revolution. In the Kabbalah, that energy center is called Chochmah. Very undeveloped in the Western world because we're trained to use the left part of our brain for critical thinking. And the intuitive part of our brain, the creative part of our brain, the brain which is in tune with our higher selves and with transcendent reality, is asleep. We don't use most of our brain. Mm-hmm. That can be entrained. And that's what meditation does, among other things. So that the root of consciousness is either in intellection, which is how we define intelligence, or it's in intuition. Now, that intuitive sense is how we connect, firstly, with the part of our soul which is not incarnated and which carries memories of our past experiences. It's the part of our soul which is connected, and you're a devotee of Jung.
Yes.
With the collective soul and with the archetypal souls. And then ultimately, because the soul is like an umbilicus, it's an extension of the divine energy through the collective into various sub-collectives, into the individual. Now, this part of our brain, this element of consciousness, enables us to tune in to our own personal past experience, into the past experience of humanity through the collective soul, and ultimately into the divine. So what is consciousness? It's those two brain energies, or those two cognitive energy centers functioning together.
But they're not separate.
No, they're not. Absolutely not. When
I mean, that's only an arbitrary distinction, so we can talk about them.
Absolutely. When Beethoven gets his aha, and hears, in quote marks, the Ninth Symphony, he still has to go out and work on the musical notation and edit. Both parts of the brain have to be in harmony. Both functions. Because you get into deep doo-doo, you'll pardon the expression, if you block this interface beyond the two between the two levels of consciousness.
Right.
Deep, deep trouble. For example, you may hide behind rational thinking to avoid your feelings, or to avoid creativity, real creativity. Or you may be out there in Alice in Wonderland because you're not prepared to subject your insights to analysis so that other people can share them and judge them. So yes, there has, and the whole thing is about harmony. The energy centers in the tree of life that govern feeling also have to be in balance. You may, through either a past life experience or usually through a childhood experience, have trained yourself to be very defended so that people won't hurt you anymore. But what you've lost is the flow of energy between the left side, which is gevura, which is defense, which is boundary, which is recoil, and chesed, which is loving. And you'll find that some people, when they're in this condition, are unable to accept love or to give love.
Because of a decision that they made a long time
back. Decision which they made when they were little children about the world.
Because
and about themselves in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then this energy center, which really is a powerful energy center, it's an energy center of the universe as well. It explains why there have to be laws in the universe, why there have to be boundaries, why planets cannot collide. But within the microcosm, it explains how we keep ourselves safe. It's called gevura.
Gevura.
But when that center becomes encrusted with dark energy,
through non-use,
it may explain aggressive behavior, abusive behavior, or inability to be open to others. And in many of the cases in the book, when that was identified as the problem area and techniques were used for taking off the shells, for removing the darkness and allowing the energy to begin to flow freely again, suddenly a person discovers that, yes, she is ready to get married. She will be accepted. She won't be judged. She won't be hurt. It is safe to take a risk.
Because I'm just thinking as you're speaking that unfortunately many individuals in our present government have a darkened gevura.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a very cogent explanation about how is it that people are doing this way.
It's not just the government. There are many religious leaders.
Oh, yeah.
Who are all judgmentalism. Who
both in the Christian arena and the Islamic arena.
Who have no sense of loving connection with people. It's all judgment. It's all boundary. It's us and them.
What is a technique that you can offer our listeners that may be of use to... I mean, certainly... And I think I saw it in your book, but in order to change the universe, one must first change oneself.
Change yourself.
Yes.
And then you go out. You know, the wonderful thing about this energy system is that it switches back. When the energy system goes through the human being, through Malchut, which is the lowest sphera, and when we speak about lowest, we're just speaking in terms of how it would look on a chart.
Position, right.
It doesn't mean lowest because it's also represented circularly.
Yeah, I saw that.
Right. But if we, on that level, there's a switchback mechanism. Okay. What we put into the world, when our energy systems are in balance and the divine energies on both sides of the tree and its trunk, the central pillar, flow freely from us, then we impact our families, we impact our communities, we impact our societies, we impact our nation, we impact the world, we impact the environment. It then switches back. Each action that we take switches the energy right back through the cosmos, so that God is described as I shall be as I shall be. The divine is affected. The divine becomes more powerful. And that energy is then switched back.
So it is a sympathetic resonance.
Yes.
Yes. And I'm really, as a piano technician, I mean, that's all. I work with that on a daily basis. So it's a matter then, in a practical sense, about making conscious decisions every day to be open and loving and to confront one's fears.
Yes, yes. And if one is stuck in one's fears, then one should open the book and see how to deal with them. Because these techniques have really been tried out, Anthony, in clinical practice over years now. And they work.
Because I noticed that is the name of each center called a sefirot?
Sefira.
Sefirot. I wanted to make sure I pronounced that right.
Sefira.
There is a way of coming to balancing the sefirot.
Yes.
Through these techniques.
Yes. And that leads to spiritual harmony. And once we are a harmonious spiritual system, everything around us You know, we're all part of a system.
Yeah.
We're part of the cosmos. You change one part of the system, everything else in the system changes. That's systemic theory. But in
cybernetic.
Right. But in psycho-spiritual terms, we're not just changing things that we can see. We're changing unseen domains as well, because the energy goes bubbling through the cosmos.
Things that we are, not only that we can't think of, but are stranger than we can think.
Right.
I think is how David Bohm said it.
And that science is making less and less strange for us.
I talked to a physicist a number of months ago, and she said that the cause and effect are the same.
I don't know what that sentence means.
And I mean that that there is a unity in momentum. I guess I would have to speak about it that way. That anyway, I'm just.
I'll tell you how the philosopher would describe, would explain what she said.
Mm-hmm.
The philosopher would say that the ultimate cause is the divine, the uncaused cause, the cause of it all, the origin of it all, of which everything else is an effect. That's old Aristotelian mm-hmm. philosophy. But if you say that there isn't the divine and everything else, but that everything is a reflection of the divine and is an aspect of the divine,
mm-hmm.
then of course cause and effect are the same.
Okay. Because I also, you know, in a way, I feel like that even the table has a consciousness, and I ought to be attending to the appropriate use of that and to be reverent of that, because that even the table or a stone is an aspect of the divine.
Absolutely.
That reflects back to...
Absolutely. You know, when people say that trees weep when you cut them.
Oh, yeah.
And that plants feel pain.
Mm-hmm. Which they demonstrated.
I don't think that that's far-fetched.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've been in an operating room watching robotic neurosurgery and heard brain cells scream
uh-huh.
when they were zapped by electrical current.
Yeah,
I've heard them scream.
Because you were attentive, you were attending in that way, at that level.
No, because it was on a monitor and there was sound. Everybody could hear.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that everything is perfused by life, which is divine being.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when we approach life, when we approach everything, it has to be with reverence. There's a passage in the book that mm-hmm. I loved writing. It's how to eat a peach mindfully. You can eat a peach like Pavlov's dog. You're hungry, your mouth waters. I'm thinking about it. My mouth is watering now.
Yes.
Or you can hold that peach in your hand and feel the texture. Look at the colors, the hues. How the oranges fade into yellow, into green. Marvel at this work of art. Look at it and say, this is a gift. I'm allowed to take something that has this energy and to make it part of my energy and say, thank you for this gift. And then bite into it slowly and become aware of the burst of moisture and the subtleties of flavor. And then as you feel it, as you become aware of how the peach is changing as you chew it, and then imagine it becoming incorporated into you so that you can go on to do the things that you're supposed to do. Then the eating of the peach becomes a mystic experience. And in the language of the Kabbalah, you have raised the divine sparks in that peach. Because you've tuned yourself in using your terms.
Well, and also you are attending in a larger sphere than only the self that is contained in the bag of skin.
Absolutely, and that's what the connecting to God means. It's not just the mystic experience that you have in deep, profound meditation.
Although that's useful training.
Going either into yourself or moving beyond yourself. It's what some great thinker once called normal mysticism. Awakening a sense of wonder to the everyday. Mm-hmm. The sense of wonder that we have when we're babies and children. And that we leave behind us when we become too busy to attend.
In Jewish mysticism, I've heard about the sound that was lost. Do you know of this? Can you speak about it?
Yeah. In Judaism, I mean, God communicates to us through the Torah. The Torah is multi-layered.
And the Torah means the truth, right?
Yeah. It's multi-layered. The words are codes. Each word has a numerical value. These codes have become very popular. You know, the Da Vinci Code, the Rule of Four, and so on. But it goes deeper than that even. The way in which the words are vocalized creates a music of expression. But the vocalization is the beginning of the music. In the Hebrew Bible, each word has a musical notation.
So Steve Rush was talking about this, by the way. And it was a rabbinical, the staff, the five lines, the musical staff, was a way of notating these vocalizations.
Yes, and these vocalizations are not just mnemonic devices. You remember things more easily if you can sing them. They also create energy and power because there's enormous power in sound. You know, that's why in mantra meditation, the sounds are powerful. Now, each one of these musical notations creates sounds that we have, but we don't know any longer exactly what the sounds used to be. We don't know the ultimate sound, which is the ineffable name of God. That sound is lost.
Well, but is it even a sound?
It's a sound beyond sound.
Yes, thank you for that.
It's a sound beyond sound.
Thank you for that. Because that's really, I feel that right in my heart.
Yes.
And it can be heard, I think, and yet with the dissolution of oneself.
That's the point. That's the point.
Because then one becomes the sound
then
of God.
Then one becomes the all. And it's not the dissolution of self. That's a paradox. It's the disillusion of what we think is self.
Okay. That's corrected, yes.
What we think is self is the guy that looks at us from the mirror. But the guy that I look at it in the mirror is not the guy that I remember of 10 years ago, who wasn't quite as gray, didn't have quite as many. You know, sometimes I look in the mirror and I say, is that guy me? So what we confuse for the self is not the self, because the self is part of the divine.
And this one
that's the energy that drives us.
Can you speak a bit more about reincarnation? There are these, to me, it seems a paradox that I'm exploring about the notion of threads of identity running through the singular identity, that we come into a new consciousness, whether it be Buddhism talks about we have the great fortune to be reincarnated in a human body in the United States of America in 2005, and we get to sit across a table from each other talking about this. I mean, it's an extraordinary, wonderful experience. But I'm curious about, and I know the Tibetan Buddhists will track how, I mean, I believe Tenzin Gyatso, who is the present Dalai Lama, is considered, and perhaps is, the reincarnation of Avalokiteshvara, which is the Buddha of compassion. But they are, the Tibetans very much track how these threads of consciousness. Can you speak about that?
Yes, we can. In fact, one of the great modern Jewish mystics, who was the chief rabbi of the Holy Land, Rabbi Isaac Cook, a marvelous figure, wonderful figure, poet, mystic, towering rabbinic authority. He tracked his soul back to Joshua, the biblical Joshua.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
That's fascinating. And it's curious to me how there can be these separate threads of souls.
They're not really separate threads. It's the one soul which keeps
okay.
coming back.
The one soul expressing itself as many threads.
Yes, with great power. And it's not only therapeutic to go back and resolve traumas and unfinished business in previous lives. It's also enlightening to go back to places where you haven't had traumatic life or traumatic experiences, but from which you have to learn. You may have gone back to a life which was stable, which was serene, but which was dreadfully unhappy because you were mm-hmm. on the wrong track. So there's great value, but there's a big caveat. There are a lot of charlatans out there.
Big
caveat.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us, Rabbi. So much appreciate
this. This has been a pleasure for me, and I hope that your listeners will buy the book.
And it's called Connecting to God, Ancient Kabbalah and Modern Psychology by Rabbi Abner Weiss. And you have connectingtogod.com.
Yes.
And that's probably the best way to get more information about the book.
Yes, absolutely. And it's helped so many people, Anthony, that the reason that I wrote it was that I decided that it's great to be able to touch one person at a time or 10 people in a group. But if many thousands of people have this wisdom available.
And it's a tool.
It's a gift.
That. Yeah.
So that's why I wrote the book. And I hope that people will take it and fly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.